Welcome and thank you for holding. At this time, your lines are in listen-only mode. If you are speaking on the call, you may use star 6 to mute and unmute your phone or use a mute feature on your phone. A public comment period is scheduled to take place after the opening remarks. If you are interested in commenting on today's topic, you may press star 1 on your phone at any time to be placed in the queue. There is a limited time set aside for public comment, so please keep your comment to less than 1 minute. Stating your name and affiliation when prompted is optional. However, please provide at least an identifying alias. This will assist in administering the session. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. And now I'd like to turn the call over to Odette Madriago. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you. I am Odette Madriago, Acting Chief Deputy Director for the Department of Toxic Substances Control, and I'm also team leader for the team that's been working on the regulations for the last year, and they are most of them all in the room with me here in Sacramento. So good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you are in the country. I want to thank each of you on the subcommittee for making your time available to work with us on this topic or the topics. The discussion that we have today and in our follow-up phone call on April 18th will provide valuable input for the discussion by the Green Ribbon Science Panel as a whole here in Sacramento on May 5th and 6th, specifically on the two topics before us today on de minimis and unintentionally added chemicals. A little bit later in the agenda, before you start your discussion, I will briefly review the topic paper that we've prepared for the call today, and there'll be a chance to ask clarifying questions. And throughout the call today, both myself and other DTSC staff are here to answer questions that you may have, and we may at times ask you questions to regarding clarifying what you're saying or providing more detail in terms of what you may be suggesting. So at that point, thank you, and I'm going to turn it over to Kathy Barwick.
Hello, my name is Kathy Barwick, and I am staff here at DTSC in the Pollution Prevention Program, and I'm also staff to the Green Ribbon Science Panel. And what I'm going to do right now is just a brief roll call of the science panel members so that everybody knows who's on the call. And then we'll go around the room here in headquarters so you'll know who here at DTSD is listening as well. Dr. Bill Carroll?
Here.
Dr. Todd Delaney?
Here.
Dr. Richard Dennison?
I'm here.
Dr. Dale Johnson?
Here.
Dr. Bob Peoples?
Present.
Dr. Joe Goof?
Here.
And Dr. Ann Blake.
Here.
Okay. And here at DTSC we have
Jeff Long.
Corey Yes. Hortensia Muniz. Kelly Kirkpatrick.
Colleen Heck.
And that's it. And me and Odette. So now I'm going to turn it over to Bill Carroll, your chair for this subgroup.
Kathy, and welcome colleagues and all those who are listening in various spots around the country. Today, as you know, we're going to be talking about the idea of de minimis chemicals and unintentionally added chemicals. As you know, in general for these discussions, we've allocated two phone calls, each of approximately 2.5 hours, and we'll sort of see how it goes. I frankly think that this topic is rather a bit less complex than a couple of the other topics, but we'll see how that goes. What we're going to do during this period, we have first a review of the document that you members have that Odette sent out from DTSC. Then we have a public comment period, an opportunity for the public to address comments to us. Those comments will be limited to 1 minute apiece. Then we have our open discussion, and we'll kind of see how it goes. We've programmed in the idea of a break approximately 10:30. I'm sorry, at 11:25 rather on Pacific time. I think once again we're going to kind of see how the discussion goes to see own locations. If you need breaks on your own, you're welcome to take that, but please don't abandon us totally.
Let's do the break at 11, Bill.
Do it at 11? All right.
Yeah, that'd be great.
We'll
and Bill, you need to stay up on your phone as well. Kind of fading in and out on us.
I'm sorry.
I'm sitting
right in front of it and doing the best I can do.
Okay.
So in any event, Odette, I guess it's your turn. Would you care to review the document that you sent out?
Sure will. So we have three main questions before us today. The first one, which we've identified as question 3A, asks, what should be the de minimis level and the criteria for establishing that level? And, of course, the de minimis is important in that if we have a de minimis exemption, this is the basis for exempting a product that's identified as a priority product from the alternatives assessment process if the chemical of concern in that product is below the de minimis level.
I'm sorry. This is Joe Guth. Can I? I'm really sorry. When did you send that document? I'm not sure. I know which document.
Last week, and it was posted on the website.
It's posted on the
Freedom Science Panel page.
I've got it dated as March 29th.
Okay. Email us the agenda, Joe.
Can you? That would be good. I really apologize.
Is somebody able to email it to him quickly, or do you have a computer where you can go onto our website, Joe?
I have the document in front of me with the email if you want to give me your email, Joe.
Okay, I'm sorry, everybody. jguth@berkeley.edu.
And Guth is G?
U-T-H.
G-U-T-H, okay. jguth@berkeley.edu.
Yes, thank you.
Right. You're welcome.
I apologize. Go ahead, Deb.
Okay. All right. So the first threshold question, obviously, is should there be a de minimis exemption or not? Now, the rest of the questions presume that there will be a de minimis exemption. So question two is should there be a set default de minimis level, for example, 0.1%, or should the de minimis level be determined chemical by chemical? Or perhaps there could be a combination, such as, for example, there could be a basic default, but with the flexibility for the department to set a different level on a chemical-by-chemical basis. So if there is a default level set, what should it be? If levels are going to be set on a chemical-by-chemical basis, what should be the basis for this determination? And the paper lays out several different possible options for basis for chemical-by-chemical level. The third question asks, should the de minimis level be applied to the product as a whole or to a component of the product? This question obviously applies to assembled as opposed to formulated products. Question four, should the de minimis level be applied individually to each chemical in the product? And here I should say we're talking about the chemical of concern. Or if there are multiple chemicals of concern in a given product or component, should the de minimis level be applied to the aggregate concentration of all chemicals of concern in a product or component that meet a specific criterion? So, for example, if the aggregate approach were used, the level could be applied to all chemicals of concern in the product that exhibit the same hazard traits or that operate on the same mode of action or some other criteria. Question five, should there be any chemical or category of chemicals for which no de minimis exemption is allowed? If this approach were used, what chemicals or categories of chemicals would you suggest that the de minimis exemption not be allowed for? And then there's the question of how should the presence or non-presence be determined? Question six, which is the last one for this main question, is which of the following should the de minimis exemption be applied to? And there's several choices here. For example, unintentional additive, and there's several different categories listed here, or intentionally added chemical ingredients, and thirdly, residual reagents and other chemicals from chemical transformation. So this is, of the three questions, this is, I think, clearly the most complex, and it is one that has been talked about extensively throughout the past year and is of great interest to most stakeholders that have been engaged with this on these regulations. The second major question, question 3B, again, assumes that there will be an exemption for de minimis. And so this question asks, what process should be used to allow an exemption for a priority product that contains a chemical at or below the de minimis level? But there's basically two choices here. One is it could be self-implementing. In other words, the manufacturer of the product could make the determination that their product contains the chemical of concern at a level below de minimis and therefore enjoy the exemption without any action or notification to DTSC. The other approach would be, again, the manufacturer would make the determination, but they would be required to submit some kind of notification to DTSC, and this lays out several options. It could be a very simple notice. It could be a notice that requires certain other kinds of information. And then there's the issue of, do they just get to notify and then exercise the exemption, or do they have to notify and obtain approval from DTSC to exercise the exemption? So those two questions pertain to de minimis. The third and last major question, question 3C, pertains to unintentionally added chemicals. And there is something of a linkage between these two issues because during the discussions in the past year, some have suggested that the de minimis exemption should only be allowed for unintentionally added chemicals. So that's why we thought it would be beneficial to have these two topics discussed by the same subcommittee. So, again, we have the basic threshold question, should there be an exemption for unintentionally added chemicals or not? And the remaining questions then presume that there would be such an exemption and dive into what the details of that exemption would be. So if there is an exemption, what kinds of unintentionally added chemicals should that exemption apply to? And some of the types that have been, you know, mentioned before are chemicals that are contained in naturally occurring content, chemicals contained in other non-recycled content, chemicals contained in recycled content, chemicals introduced from the air or from water, used as a processing aid or as an ingredient, or should this be limited solely to chemicals that are below the de minimis level? And there are probably other ideas that some of you may think of here. Question three is, what steps, if any, should a manufacturer be required to take to obtain knowledge about the presence of unintentionally added chemicals? In other words, in order to exercise this exemption, should the manufacturer be required to take some sort of action, a reasonable action, to determine if there are certain unintentionally added chemicals present in their product? And if there is going to be a requirement like that, the final question asks, should the exemption apply to an unintentionally added chemical about which the manufacturer has knowledge of that chemical's presence in their product? So that is a review of the questions before you today. And at this point, I will turn it back over to Bill.
Thank you, Odette. And also, you didn't specifically mention it, but as part of the document that we received, there's a summary of the relevant parts of the statute for this discussion that's also there as kind of a chapeau on the rest of the document, and if necessary, you can go back to that. All right, so where we are right now is at a time for an opportunity for public comment, I guess I would ask the operator whether there are callers in the queue.
At this time, there are no callers in queue.
Fine. Could I go around to the various sites and ask if there are people at these sites who would like to speak? There are none here with me.
There are none here with me in Florida.
What a big surprise, Joe.
I'm in Berkeley. At Dale Jass's office.
Okay. In DTSC?
No.
Nope.
None in Washington at the ACS building.
None in Washington at EDF.
None with Delaney in New Jersey.
Okay, so it's a pretty hot topic today, then, isn't it?
Yep.
Okie doke. Then I guess we're pretty much set as far as the public comment is concerned, and I
Bill, are you there?
I am.
Oh, okay.
We keep losing you.
That may be it may also be the other noise in your room. Whenever you're on, I hear a distinct hum. You've got a pretty good sized fan there, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's a bummer.
And apparently we have to have that fan on in order to conduct a conference call.
Carbon dioxide buildup would be such that you'd all suffocate.
I don't know.
Well, let's go ahead and start the discussion. And as Odette mentioned, the threshold question is, should there be a de minimis exemption of some kind or not? And I'll open it up to the crowd. Who'd like to start?
Bill, this is Richard. Could we ask a couple clarifying questions, perhaps?
Certainly. Go right ahead.
I'm having a hard time hearing you, Richard.
Okay.
Thank you.
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. Can someone remind us of whether in the statute itself there is any reference to de minimis levels or any related issues, or is this something that is being addressed for consideration of the practicality in the regulatory process?
No, the statute does not specifically address the issue of de minimis, and it's, you know, I think we view it as being part of prioritization, you know, and the statute does call upon us to prioritize chemicals of concern in products, which gets us to prioritizing products that then move on to the alternatives assessment process. And so I think the best way to view de minimis is, maybe the threshold question is really, should de minimis be used as a way to help us prioritize those products that we, the department, and the manufacturers and other stakeholders spend their time on in the alternatives assessment process.
Richard, my reading of this is that it isn't specifically outlined in the statute, but neither is it disallowed. And it sort of comes under, in the bullets that Odette sent out to me, it comes under the potential for exposure to the chemical in a consumer product that leaves open the opportunity for setting a lower priority for materials of a lower concentration. But I don't think there's a specific mention of it in the statute.
So if I could do a follow-up, that was really my question. Is this being proposed as a separate step in what is otherwise the prioritization process that is called for, or is it not already a factor that would be going into identifying both which chemicals are priorities and which products in which those chemicals are used are priorities?
Well,
see what
from
I'm
a practical
saying?
Standpoint, it would have to come into play after the department has already identified the priority product. Now, in identifying priority products, the department is gathering information in terms of the typical volume and concentration of a chemical concern in a particular product or product category, and that certainly goes into the prioritization decision. But then there is the factor that for a given product or category, different manufacturers may have different amounts of a chemical concern in their product. So some manufacturers may have that chemical present well above de minimis, and other manufacturers for the same type of product would have it below de minimis. So for a practical standpoint, it has to take place after the department has identified the priority product and the manufacturers then go and look at their product.
Okay, thanks very much.
Richard, you want to follow up on that and comment?
Not yet.
Okay. All right. So who else would like to take a crack at this?
This is Todd, and just speaking as a chemical engineer, and from a process standpoint, we all know that anything that we produce from a standpoint of, or almost anything that we produce through chemical engineering in a chemical plant is going to have impurities in it that may end up being fitting into this, and so consequently, there has to be a de minimis just from the standpoint of the practicality that you're going to have these things in almost any manufactured chemical. Obviously, it's the amount that makes the difference later on. So I think the first question, should there be a de minimis exemption? Yes.
Thank you, Todd. And I'd like each of us to take a crack at this because it is sort of a threshold question. Recognize we're not voting on anything here, but I think it's important to kind of get the basic thought on this from each of the members of the group. So who'd like to go next?
Bill, it's Bob Peoples.
Go ahead, Bob.
And I would certainly echo the last comment, and I, you know, my vote would be yes, there should be a de minimis exemption here. So I guess the real debate is where do you set that from a practical point of view? When I think about trying to execute the spirit of the statute, I think about what can we do to get the process started, which means, you know, you got to draw a line in the sand somewhere, and maybe we just call that phase one, come to some kind of agreement on what a de minimis level should be, and we may have to temper that to whether we're talking about synthetic versus naturally occurring chemicals. We could debate that a little bit later. And once we learn from that, gain experience in the process, you could go back in the future and revise this as necessary based on the practicalities of what's been learned.
Thank you, Bob. Next.
This is Richard. Bill, I'll weigh in now.
Go ahead.
I think I just want to caveat what I'm about to say because I think the question of whether or not there should be a de minimis begs the question of whether or not we're talking about a single level de minimis that would apply across the board or not. So I'm not I'm assuming that would not necessarily be the case, but with that caveat, I would say that I would also draw a distinction between intentional versus unintentional additions, and would support the idea of a de minimis or unintended, but not for intentional intentionally added material. And I want to reflect back on an experience some 20 years back when a related issue was being raised in the context of developing what became a national heavy metals in packaging restriction, where there was a de minimis level set for the presence of lead, cadmium, and other heavy metals in packaging that was there precisely because they were co-contaminants or came along with the primary materials that were intentionally added, and they were, and the aim of that statute was to distinguish between intentional addition of those metals versus unintentional, and the de minimis threshold applied only to the unintended presence of the contaminants in question. So that's the approach that I would support here.
This is Odette. I'm sorry. We need to interrupt the process here a little bit. We just got a note that there are some people calling in from another number who did want to make public comments and couldn't get through to the operator. So, operator, Jeff, are you?
Yes. We do have two in queue right now.
I think that we should. Is Richard? Were you finished with your comment? I'm sorry. I was assuming that you were.
Yeah, so Dad, I was.
Okay. So I know it's a little awkward, but I think that since they had a technical difficulty getting through, we better reopen the public comment period.
Odette, I'm fine with that, but let me make one suggestion. We're sitting now at, 9:59 or so Pacific time. The public comment period was listed for 10:10 on the agenda. Do you want to wait until 10:10 and then clear the line just to be sure that there aren't a couple of other stragglers who were basing it on the schedule?
That's a good idea. Okay. Well, Kathy also did say that there are no times on the public agenda, so I'm fine with doing it however you're most comfortable, Bill.
Fine. Let's clear it now.
Okay.
Jeff, operator, we want to go ahead and identify callers in the queue.
The first public comment is from Paul. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Paul DeLeo with the American Cleaning Institute. I just wanted to comment on some of the scientific background or that you might use in terms of looking at the question of establishing thresholds. In particular, I'm thinking of the threshold of toxicological concern concept, which is used to establish safe exposure.
We're having trouble hearing you, sir.
Sorry, I'll try this a little differently. I just wanted to comment on some of the scientific information you might use in terms of considering a de minimis threshold, in particular the threshold of toxicological concern concept, which is used to estimate safe exposure levels for chemicals for which there may not be toxicological data available. And an example of that is something in the late 90s they did at the Food and Drug Administration with regard to chemicals used in food packaging materials and related types of materials, where they established a threshold using available toxicological data on a sort of a sample set, looking at potency of different compounds, and they set a threshold for any chemical that might be used there. So that's an example of an application that's been around for a while, and Richard made reference to another example, which I trust was had similar scientific underpinnings. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is there are examples out there of regulatory approaches that have been conducted, and I'd look forward to hearing how you all work with existing thresholds that may have been established and the scientific basis for establishing those in your deliberations going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Operator, next caller.
The next public comment comes from Maya. Your line is open.
Thank you. This is Maya Jack with the Grocery Manufacturers Association, and thank you for the opportunity to address this subcommittee on de minimis and unintentionally added ingredients. Regarding the de minimis threshold, GMA believes that there is precedent in many regulations globally for a 0.1% weight-by-weight threshold. So we would support that amount. And in regards to one of the questions in terms of notification, we're concerned that notification on everything can lead to an excessive, burdensome, and unnecessary reporting, and they should be reserved for priority chemicals and priority products that are intentionally added, accessible to the consumer, and above the de minimis threshold. So I'd be interested to hear more about some of these issues that are just being discussed by the subcommittee. Thank you.
There's a pretty good chance you'll get your wish.
Now, Bill?
Yes?
This is Bob. May I just ask for the name of that manufacturers association? I didn't catch it.
It was the Grocery Manufacturers Association, Bob.
Thank you, Richard.
Are there other callers, operator?
Yes, at this time we have one more.
Okay.
Our next public comment is from Dawn. Your line is open.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Odette. I was panicked when we couldn't get through, because I knew a few of us wanted to see if they willingness to come back to public comment. So, Dawn Kepke, on behalf of the Green Chemistry Alliance, and just wanted to thank you for the opportunity to just present a few thoughts from the Alliance. GCA has consistently advocated that the regulations should apply only to intentionally added ingredients that serve a functional purpose at or above 0.1% de minimis level, which we believe is consistent with many other state, federal, and international systems by which manufacturers are already currently regulated. We are concerned that unintentional constituents cannot be included if this is to become a feasible program that focuses on the important safety concerns that will not result in excessive testing and wasted resources. Furthermore, requiring manufacturers to evaluate and find alternatives to chemicals that may have an incidental presence in consumer products will not necessarily result in significant improvements that are anticipated by the overall initiative. With regard to the 0.1 de minimis level, we do acknowledge that there may be some instances where a chemical may warrant a lower or higher threshold. And we are certainly open to, on a case-by-case basis, determining a lower or higher threshold concentration that is identified by other bodies, authoritative bodies that are out there that have set different levels. And we just really urge that be on a case-by-case basis. We don't think we need to reinvent the wheel on those alternative thresholds. We think that we can rely on other work that's already been done. Additionally, with regard to unintentional constituents, which become priority chemicals, we believe that they should be regulated against the de minimis established for that chemical. To put an inordinate focus on recycled materials, as an example, in the short term, and not may not be the best investment for the overall effort. And we think it's better
to wrap up.
You bet. Better to have the program focus on dealing with unintentional ingredients, which essentially we believe will drive the long-term improvement. As far as intentional, then focus on intentional. We think that there's already precedent through the Toxics and Packaging Act and California law under Health and Safety Code Section 25214.12D-E. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Dawn. And just to check, there are no further callers, correct?
I show no comments at this time.
Okay, very good. Thank you. All right. Well, let's review the bidding then. I've heard from Todd and Bob and Richard. And Joe, Dale, someone else want in here?
This is Ann. I'd like to follow on some of the comments that have just happened.
Please do.
Okay. So following primarily on Richard's comments and also with Dawn, I totally understand the practicalities of dealing with unintentionally added chemicals and looking for those and understanding the impact of impurities. However, my concern is having a de minimis for classes of chemicals, and perhaps this is addressed by Dawn's suggestion that there be either chemical by chemical, but I would add class by class, a different threshold for those for which there is toxicologically no safe dose, as it were. So things like PBTs, PMRs, and endocrine disruptors. My challenge is that I'm struggling with is how you actually implement that, but I just want to throw that out there as I would support potentially the division between intentionally and unintentionally added, but some of our biggest concerns have come from unintentionally added residuals, and I'm not real quite sure how to tackle that with this, but that's where I am at the moment.
Thank you, Ann. Joe, Dale?
Dale. On the first question, should there be a de minimis exemption, and I would say yes, absolutely. And then I'll comment on the idea of, I think that Paul from the American Cleaning Institute brought up the threshold of toxicological concern and the various potency of compounds. And a lot of that, of course, as we know, the food industry has been regulated under the de minimis type of regulation, I'd say, for the last 30 or 40 years. And it relates to deriving this threshold level and then somehow extrapolating that into a microgram per day over a lifetime consumption level. Then have established that for both foods and it includes, and I'm pretty sure it includes both intentional and unintentional. And then there are various exemptions or criteria of different types of compounds where it falls out from that particular criteria. So a lot of the thing gets established down to something like a 1.5 microgram per day, considering a lifetime exposure, and that does include carcinogens and genotoxic compounds. So where the issues come up is in all of those types of calculations, that also is part of the impurity calculations when you get to pharmaceutical action. And there's also some later discussions of that in terms of drinking water using the same types of approaches and inhalation exposure. And also a lot of work that's being done in Europe right now on just household products in relationship to that, including cosmetics and so on and so forth. So the thing is to be able to apply a certain type of risk calculation into it based on what a potential exposure would be and a consumption over a period of time. And so those And fortunately or unfortunately, everything is derived from what we call a dose response curve, and extrapolating down into the very lower end of the dose response curve, assuming that everything follows that type of dose response. And so for those particular compounds that don't, and they would include some natural products, which includes proteins, for instance, so anything like that does not follow a normal dose response curve. And then heavy metals are also excluded for that. And then anything that gets accumulated in the body so that once it's accumulated, doesn't follow a dose response curve because the pharmacokinetics are different. So there are classes of compounds, classes of products that don't fall directly into a standardized type of number. But the number itself should represent what we consider to be risk in terms of it's in a product, then somehow that product, that material gets out of the product and gets into human, that type of approach. So whether that's the 0.1% weight per weight and how that translates into human exposure, to me has always been kind of the issue, but there definitely should be a de minimis level. I don't think you could actually run any type of consumer product or industry or regulations without it. I think it would be too cumbersome. So I think what we will have to do is, in this type of discussion, is really understand how priority chemicals fall into a standardized de minimis level, and particularly on the front end through implementing the regulation, and then start to look over time how that might be, there might be exemptions for that, and start dealing with different products.
Thank you, Dale. Joe, I'd like to hear from you, and then I'll take a turn.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm sympathetic to the notion of a de minimis, you know, level in some kinds of regulatory contexts, and we're all quite familiar with them, but I'm not so sure I think it's appropriate in this particular context, because what we're talking about is a situation where DTSC has identified a priority chemical, right? So we're not talking about just... So maybe there, if there's a contaminant that if a priority chemical happens to be introduced as a contaminant, I suppose that could be an issue. But I'm not sure how likely that is, unless I don't know, maybe it's lead or something that comes along with the water. But anyway, we're going to have first priority chemical identified. I think at first, how many are there going to be? I mean, I think we were recommending DTSC try to start with a dozen or two just to get their arms around this process, and then priority products, which will be some subclass of all the products that have a priority chemical in them. And then all we're talking about here is, you know, what the de minimis exemption does is then eliminates priority products that contain a priority chemical from having to do an alternatives analysis or taking the next step. I mean, there's no other regulatory consequence to a priority product having a priority chemical, you know, at over at the minimum level. So I guess I'm thinking that if we're going to have a fairly small number of priority chemicals in, you know, some group of priority products, which presumably would be chosen because there's a lot of exposure potential or they're widespread or some factors that lead them to be priority products after all, I'm not sure why we should exempt, you know, any of those products from going through an alternative analysis and seeing whether that priority chemical really needs to be, you know, in their product. And I guess I would just say then, if maybe the point at which to do this would be when DTSC identifies the priority products so that they could say, here's our list of priority chemicals, here's our list of priority products, and priority products for in these particular cases that have, we'll apply a de minimis level because we don't think that's high priority, you know, in a particular case. that would seem to me to be, at least at the outset, maybe, you know, a better way to make sure that we're actually going to do a real alternative analysis on what's probably going to start out as a fairly, you know, limited universe of situations.
Thank you, Joe. And I'd like to go now, and I'd like to address this by sort of arguing it from the opposite. What if you do not set a de minimis level for materials, and particularly for unintentionally added materials or for residuals from previous reactions? If you do not set a de minimis level, then effectively the level is zero. And what you have asked people to prove is that there is none of a particular material in a product, and that's impossible. The best that you can do is to demonstrate that it's not present at some set detection limit or quantitation limit, but zero cannot be quantified. We learned this on a very practical basis going back 40 years with experience in vinyl chloride when much of this kind of regulation was new. And the first approach that was taken was to say that there should be zero emissions of vinyl chloride from a facility, which means not a single molecule. And under those circumstances, no one could make that sort of guarantee. And so early on in the history of regulations, we evolved to a point of determining limits, setting them, and even throughout the world, at the very least, you see that there are rules with respect to detection limits and quantitation limits that come into play. So to me, what it comes down to is a de minimis level or zero, and to me, zero is impossible.
Well, how do you feel about then a de minimis level that was set at detection levels? I'm sympathetic to that argument, but you know, 0.1% is in most cases far above a detection limit.
Well, first of all, Joe, we're going to get to that, but I'll answer your question directly by saying a detection limit is also a very difficult regulatory standard, because unless you set what that detection limit is, you're continually pushed by analytical chemists, and you effectively have no standing in regulation for it.
Okay, right. Well,
What I'm compelled by is the need to set some kind of limit under some set of rules, and to recognize that there is a difference between materials that are intentionally added as ingredients and materials that are not intentionally added and may or may not be present. And frankly, maybe this is another interesting question to discuss. I don't know how you do an alternatives analysis on an unintentionally added material.
Well, water can be purified.
Bill, this is Richard. I want to pick up on your last point because that's why I made the distinction, I think, between intentional and unintentional. So if something is intentionally added, then one presumably knows that it is present and even the level at which it is present.
Right.
Whereas I agree with you that with an unintended or byproduct, residual, et cetera, the quandary you raise is a legitimate one, and that's where I do think a de minimis or a set of de minimis levels, depending on classes, as Anne described, would be appropriate there.
Bill, this is Anne, obviously. What I'm thinking of in terms of contaminants and unintentionally added ingredients are the issues that we've discussed before and that you've brought up in discussions before, which is processes where you're not looking at an alternative for the chemical per se, but you may be looking at an alternative for the process. So, for example, ethoxylated surfactants or toluene that's got, you know, a byproduct in it because of the way it's produced or because of the chemical it's produced. So I really don't see how to implement it, but that's the concern. So I would be comfortable with doing the separation of intentional and unintentionally added and then dealing perhaps with classes of processes, and I know the Natural Products Association has thought about this for cosmetics, that there are certain processes that are known to have some contaminants in them and potentially dealing with it that way. That's not a de minimis by chemical or by product. That's a different focus. So that's what I'm struggling with on how you'd implement that in these regulations.
I see. Let me stop us here and say that we've gotten tired of the de minimis or not question because we've sort of broken out into some of the other considerations that are listed further down on the page. And I guess I'm going to try to take these things as we go, although this discussion, I think, kind of naturally groups itself. And perhaps the next part of the discussion might, and I'm looking for some input here, might reasonably be bounded by what we have as questions 2, 3, and 4. Do you all have those in front of you?
Yes.
Okay. So where the questions are, should there be a set default level or should it be determined chemical by chemical, and if so, how? Should the level be applied to the product as a whole or to each component? And should it be applied individually for each chemical or the aggregate of all chemicals? Does that seem like a reasonable suite of things to attack together, seeing the caveats that you have in front of you, or is that grouping too much? What I don't want to do is, if we can help it, is wind up taking all the considerations at once and not having an opportunity to really focus down on a couple of subsets.
Could you clarify that, Bill? So you want us to tackle the first chunk of questions under question 3A?
Right. I'm suggesting under 3A, 2, 3, and 4.
Sounds reasonable to me. I think
yeah,
we're already tackling
yeah.
it. So.
Yeah.
Because I think we've already kind of spilled over into it. And what that says is then after that, we can go after 5 and 6, which either down to is now we're kind of into the how you might set a level if you were going to have one, and whether it should be on a chemical by chemical basis for the whole product or each component, and individually for each chemical as a component of that or for the aggregate. Do you have thoughts on this?
This is Todd. Could we have a straw dog product so that we'd all be able to focus on basically the same thing as opposed to thinking about 15 or different types of products so that we could then maybe work our way through on one so we're all thinking about the same thing?
Could I suggest two products, one a formulated chemical and one that's got more materials in it, like a laptop?
That's great.
That's exactly where I was going to go, Anne. Thank you. So given those two examples, do you have feelings about these questions and whether there's a difference between them?
Bill, this is Bob.
Bob.
Just for clarification, because I like this formulated product and laptop concept to help guide the discussion, I know that Anne mentioned something about process. And I look at the language of the statute, and I think if I understand it correctly, it does not speak to process. It speaks to consumer products and chemicals of concerns in those products. Now, process may be a factor in what is and isn't incorporated, but process in and of itself is outside the scope of what we're trying to do.
And Bob, I'm going to put words in Anne's mouth here because I think she was bringing that up, and I think it was particularly Anne, from the idea of how you would do alternatives assessment. So we're kind of past that part of it, that you have the – you could, in an alternatives assessment, choose your alternatives as, for example, a plastic bottle versus a glass bottle rather than to modify the materials from which a plastic was made. So
or
it's kind of, in a way, it's outside the bounds of this question, and it's my fault for bringing it up in the first place.
I don't think it's anybody's fault. I think it's part of the intellectual debate we have to have to get our minds around what we're trying to accomplish. So I think we're okay.
So if I can respond to Bill, yes, Bill, you put the right words in my mouth, and yes, I understand, Bob, that that's outside the scope, but that's that it really is the alternatives assessment piece, and it may not apply at this point. I think at this point we're talking about how do we address the product and a de minimis in a product, or is it per component?
So we have these two models, a formulated product and an assembled product, if you will.
So this is Dale. On the question two, should there be a set default or chemical by chemical or combination? And my feeling is that it's a combination, so that there are some chemicals and some classes of chemicals that would fit right into a default, and then there are others that are going to probably drop out of that. So I would not like to see it just a chemical by chemical every time, because I think that is too onerous on both sides of the issue, both from a regulatory standpoint and a product manufacturing or distribution standpoint. So I would suggest that it is a combination of the two, and when we start to set up what the priority products are and the priority chemicals, I think they will drop out into these categories very nicely.
This is Richard. I'll be interested, Dale, to hear a little more about that, how you see that falling out. I'm not quite sure I know what you're thinking, but I do think there needs to be a chemical by chemical aspect to this, and that using a number like 0.1%, in addition to believing that level is way too high, that it, the one size fits all aspect of it is not true to the science. I also want to briefly address one of the public comments. I think it was Paul that raised this concept of the threshold of toxicological concern, because I think it raises the very problem we're grappling with here. That whole concept of CTC is based on a presumption that there's a safe level of exposure to a chemical below which there is no risk. And that concept is increasingly at odds with emerging science and understanding of how chemicals interact with a diverse human population. So I would have a great deal of problem either with a single numeric value that would apply across the board or with a concept like that that assumes a threshold as a basis for setting it. Having said that, I think what Dale said earlier, in your earlier comment, Dale, about needing to address the setting of a level using a risk approach that considers the shape of the dose response curve and establishes some basis for setting thresholds based on that, which would necessarily be chemical by chemical, would be the general approach I would support.
And I'll follow up on that, Dale, again. There will be, from a scientific standpoint, there will be a number of chemicals that will fall into the priority chemical list that will, in fact, have had the, let's call it the threshold type of analysis done, and they will fall either above or below those particular levels that are set. Now, again, the key part of it is that the analysis should be made on risk and risk over a period of time, as simply opposed to a, let's call it either a concentration or a percentage in a product. That percentage has to relate somehow to risk. And when we actually get to the list of priority chemicals, I think we will see that there are, the majority of those chemicals have had that kind of analysis done on it. Now, the issue will be those chemicals where there are no data or there are very little data. And currently, those are done through that threshold analysis, and they're done through more of a computational approach to fill the gap. I think one of the issues I see, and this is also coming from Ann's example, is if you have a manufacturing of a certain thing, and I'll just use, let's just say it's a pharmaceutical product, which is there's a fairly high purity content, but you do have unintentional impurities that are there. And in many cases, you could call them unintentional, but they aren't. They're identified because they're part of the process. So a lot of times the issue on what's intentional or unintentional on items like that becomes a little confusing.
Next up, anyone? Ann, I heard your name called. Do you want to jump in here?
Actually, this is Kathy. I'd like to jump in and remind the gentlemen to identify themselves when they're speaking, please. Ann, back to Ann.
I don't have a response per se, although I'm struggling with something here. So there's a distinction between intentionally and unintentionally added, and what Dale brought up is, and what I was suggesting earlier with the process contaminants,
yeah,
that there are things that you might know of and are identified, but so then the question of intention becomes a sort of squirrely one. You know it's there, but you can't avoid it. I think Todd brought it up originally. There, any process you make, you're going to have some kind of impurity.
But I guess, this is Richard, I guess I see that I agree. The question is, to what would the de minimis apply?
Right.
And I guess I see that as a little bit of a separate issue. Certainly if you're looking to prioritize a chemical and its use in particular priority products, then you would want to account for the fact that if it's always accompanied by a contaminant that is highly risky, that ought to be factored into the prioritization process. But whether the de minimis level would then apply to that contaminant, I think, is a separate question.
This might actually address my concern then, because then if there are known contaminants and we apply the de minimis, can you avoid the de minimis by saying it was unintentionally added? If it's a known contaminant, then it's not an unintentionally added chemical? That's what I'm struggling with. You're right, it's a different question.
It's a difficult question, and let me give you an example. Because of the world we live in, there's dioxin all around us. So finding something that has zero dioxin is going to be rather difficult. It would be obviously an unintentionally added material, but it might also be a known material. So you kind of there is certainly at least that opportunity that can happen.
So this is Bob, and I'm going back to what I thought was a great idea about having a couple example straw dog products. And if I think about a formulated product, I'm wrestling with the idea that somebody needs a surfactant in their product, and it's a surfactant that's manufactured through a synthetic sequence, and there may be some byproducts. They're unintentional, but we know they exist and they're there. And how do we deal with that versus a natural oil that may be selected as part of that formulated product? And there are some, quote, natural unintended materials in there. And is there a difference between those two? And my instincts are telling me, yes, there are, but I don't know how to translate that into language that makes sense here yet.
I guess the difficulty for me is the answer to most of these questions is, it depends.
That's Todd.
Well, exactly. Which is
my best joke, Bill.
And when you bring up what was just mentioned before your comment, that if you've got a formulation where you know that there's byproducts of the chemical reactions that are in it, but then you also know that when you add a natural oil from something, you also have other materials that are in that, and it then goes to whether it's intentional or not. I think it's, in that case, we know or we don't. Well, in both cases, we know or have a good idea that it's there, and we're not intentionally adding them from the sense that we've taken a bottle of this material and put it in, but it comes along as a co-product or a byproduct with the material that we're looking for. And I think that's where you get into this discussion, or at least I'm having trouble with, is to, you know, at what level do you look at it? The problem is that it is still there. We still know that it's probably there, so we really have to address it. And it really should be come out as de minimis if on a chemical-by-chemical basis there's no impact.
Was that Todd?
Yes.
Yes, very good. Thank you. So
this is Joe Goose.
Go ahead, Joe.
All right, thank you. Well, on that point, probably I'm familiar as a lawyer with struggling over what is a person's intention, and probably if they know that there's a chemical in, say, water that they're adding to a product and they go ahead and use it, they're probably intentionally adding that chemical, even if it's not performing any particular industrial function in the product. They know it's there, they're mixing it, they're doing it on purpose. So I think there is room for, maybe this is what you're suggesting, including in the definition of intentional that we're talking about, as there being industrial purpose, functional purpose for the product, to distinguish that from a chemical that's just adventitiously coming along in a process that you just assume get rid of is not, but don't know how to do it or it isn't worth it. But the larger point I wanted to make was, and maybe it's similar to the one I was making before. We're trying to decide here what de minimis level but ought to be for, and it's going to apply to all products, all chemicals, because we're not talking about anything specific here. And I think we can all think of situations where that's, you know, an example where it's appropriate and one where it's not appropriate that we would all agree on. So I guess I want to go back to feeling a little uncomfortable establishing a de minimis exemption at this stage in the regulation that just applies in advance of knowing what chemicals we're talking about, what products we're talking about, and just suggest again that why not have this be an option for DTSC in when they define priority products.
Thank you, Joe. And let me jump in here just for a second. I think, first of all, Joe, I want to reinforce a point that you made that I think is a significant advance in the discussion. And I've forgotten the exact words that you gave, but I hope Odette wrote them down with respect to something that serves an intended function rather than adventitiously brought along. Was that essentially your language?
Yes.
Yeah, and I think that advances the debate significantly beyond the idea of intentional and unintentional. I think one of the reasons why I jumped on this absolutely marvelous observation that it depends is because I think we could probably devise hard cases for almost anything that you'd intend to do. So, for example, my hard case is how many intentionally added materials at less than a tenth of a percent in the interior of a fabricated device really pose much of a threat to the user. That's certainly a different case than if it's a tenth of a percent of something hazardous that's added to a face cream or something that would be ingested. I mean, those are two very different kinds of situations and might require two different kinds of analysis. Where you may come down is that you might decide that there is the need for a de minimis level, at least for unintentionally, perhaps intentionally added materials.
Bill, this is Richard.
Yes.
If I could speak to your last example and then give an earlier example.
Would it be okay if I finish the point before I forget it?
Oh, my apologies. I didn't mean to jump in. Sorry.
A formulated product that is for, you know, direct dermal contact. So where I'm going with this, and forgive me for prattling on, is to say you might decide that there is a default level for de minimis that is either appealable or modifiable or adjustable by the department, modulated by the kind of products that have been chosen as priority products, particularly, or modulated by the kind of products that they are, or for that matter, the kind of hazard that the chemical presents, that your de minimis might well be a starting point and not necessarily an ending point that allows for further analysis upon either appeal or action by the department. Now, Richard, it's all yours.
My apologies, Bill. You were cutting in and out a bit, so I didn't realize you were continuing there. But to that example, it seems to me that the question you raise about, you know, the use of something in a skin cream versus the interior component of a laptop would be a factor that would heavily influence DTFC's decision about what kind of chemical and product to prioritize.
Yep.
And that it really ought to enter in at that point in the process as opposed to being a subsequent question of de minimis. And I want to throw out another example that maybe is a laptop example as well, because, Joe, it kind of speaks to your question of function. So you have flame retardants put in the plastic casing of a laptop. And that flame retardant is principally designed to be one compound, but we know that in the synthesis of that compound, there are other congeners or other. So, for example, DECA brominated diphenyl ether has contaminants of lesser brominated compounds that are part of the process of making DECA. They actually have flame retardancy properties themselves. But the Europeans had to grapple with this in a number of contexts where the presence of a contaminant, quote unquote, that was nonetheless still functional was a problem. And I can't remember quite how they resolved that. Others might know.
All right, I want to throw in here that we've had a fair amount of discussion on the level here and various examples. But what we haven't talked much about, and I'd like to direct you to this for a little bit of discussion, please, is do you apply to the product as a whole, or particularly for our example of a fabricated article, to each individual component? And should the minimus be applied individually for each chemical or to an aggregate concentration of all chemicals in the product where you might have a number of micro-constituents?
So to follow on your point, in answer to that first question, and to echo the it depends, it sounds like that's the easiest way to address that would be to say have it modulated by the type of product. So I would apply it to the, let's see if I get this right, for the product as a whole for a formulated chemical. Quote me on this. And to each component of the product for an assembled product.
That's certainly a reasonable analysis, Ann. Others?
This is Todd. I would agree with Ann on that. That's the way I've been thinking of it.
This is Dale. Just going back, is that on the individual chemical or the aggregate of chemicals in the product? Haven't gotten there yet?
My sense from Ann was that we were talking about, as an example, an individual chemical either in the formulated material or in a fabricated article, and that there was a difference between the two.
Right. And this is Dale again. Just go back to the concept of the threshold of toxicological concern again, because in that type of analysis, you assume the worst-case scenario that the entire amount of chemical then gets consumed or gets into the body or so forth. And I think this is slightly different in terms of that because in this case, I don't think we're saying in a worst-case scenario that it's 0.1%, and that 0.1% all gets released and goes into into the consumer. I don't think we're saying that. We're saying something other than that.
So what is your suggestion?
Well, if you're dealing with a threshold level, you have to make make the worst case scenario assumption. Everything gets released and goes into the consumer. And so when you set a percent level in a product, the question always comes up, are you taking the worst case scenario saying that all of that chemical gets released and gets into the individual? And I think in some cases in terms of a de minimis, you are coming to that conclusion. But I don't think that under this situation with the large array of the different types of products, I don't think you can come to that conclusion.
No, what I think we're doing is we're using it as a proxy for exposure, potential exposure.
I think that's where, you know, if you follow the logical discussion, I think that's sort of where we're all going. If you review that it's a matter of the kind of product and the kind of material and the kind of potential that someone has to be exposed to, I think we're once again using the product as a surrogate for exposure.
The worst case scenario?
I hate to use worst case scenario because there's always a worst case that you can imagine than the worst one that you come up with. So
I'm trying to picture chewing on internal components of the laptop.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Because applying it across the board assumes a worst case scenario that everything gets released.
This is Bob. With respect to the scope, are we supposed to be taking into account end of life considerations, and do we view workers as consumers in this particular case?
I know. I direct that to Odette. Sorry, Odette.
Hi. Well, you know, obviously, you know, end of life is a consideration because that's a particular point where you can have environmental impacts as well as sometimes public health impacts. In terms of workers, the answer is probably not quite as clear cut because it depends upon what other, you know, protections are in place in the workplace. But, you know, we're really looking to you guys for your suggestions and your guidance at this point. And I guess as long as I'm talking, let me just say that as we're going forward here, I think we in the department right now at least are having a hard time understanding what your individual recommendations are that would guide us in answering these questions. Now, maybe that's something that will get clarified as you get more to the end of your discussion today, or maybe we need to circle back next time and be really focused, each of you, on being able to answer these questions. But, for example, you know, when we ask if the level is set by chemical, and there's been a lot of discussion that maybe we have a combination approach, and we're asking what should the basis be, I haven't really heard anything very concrete that would guide us in how we address that question.
All right. Let me take just a second to say that perhaps a way we could approach this, Odette, to get you what you need is, one of two approaches. One is at the end of the day to ask people to summarize their thoughts and recommendations on the part of this agenda that we get through. The other would be to ask you as part of your homework for the next time.
Okay. That sounds good.
Pull those thoughts and read them into the record. Without debate, it's simply a matter of here's my 1 minute on what I think. Would either of those get the job done for you, Odette?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Then for the colleagues, tuck that in the back of your mind as two potential ways that we can be responsive to the department. We'll talk about those a little as we go on. I haven't heard much on the idea of de minimis individually by chemical or to an aggregate concentration of minority constituents. Do you have thoughts on that?
So, Bill, this is Richard. Let me speak to 3 and 4. I do agree that the de minimis level ought to be applied to the product as a whole in a formulated product case. I think in terms of a fabricated product, the concept I would toss out is the concept of separable components. So, for example, with a laptop, you would want to consider the battery that's easily removed differently than the rest of the laptop, perhaps. Although I think if we are talking about end of life, that might be complicated by the fact that that computer may be disassembled. In terms of the question 4, I think we're talking about a relatively small number of chemicals that would have made it through both the prioritization of the chemicals process and the prioritization of the product, so that it, to me, doesn't aggregating across multiple priority chemicals within a given product, it's not as if we're going to have 30 chemicals, likely. We're maybe going to have 1 or 2 or 3. So I would argue that those ought to be, the de minimis level ought to be applied individually for each chemical.
Oh, you're thinking, I'll jump in and say I pretty much agree with Richard, with the exception that if you were to decide to do it the other way, then I would feel strongly that it should be done only to aggregate materials that have the same mode of action. So, for example, and it's a trivial example, if you were to take the various congeners of dioxins, which are presumed to have the same mode of action, although I realize what the debate is here, that would be a reasonable aggregation. But to take things that have very different modes of action probably is not a reasonable aggregation.
I regard that as a friendly amendment, Bill.
And this is Todd. I would have been thinking along that same line. So.
Now, this is Dale, and actually I agree with that approach and with the amendment. It makes sense.
And this is Bob. I think I agree with both of what was said here, but I'm just wondering from a practical point of view, if it might not be easier to just take the, you know, not do the amendment, although it should be possibly a consideration in a footnote or something, that it could be simpler from an implementation point of view to use the description that Richard gave on an individual component basis, because if you start getting into judgments about mode of action, that brings that, you know, that muddies the water, makes it harder to make that call. So your dioxin example, Bill, is probably a realistic, you know, assumption. But suppose people start applying that across a variety of classes or types of chemicals, and then it really gets into the gray zone.
And, Bob, remember, I started off by saying that I wasn't crazy about aggregating, but if you were going to do it, that was one example, and it's probably a trivial example, but to me it was the most obvious example of where you might reasonably do that. My going in position would be that you would have to make the case as to why you would aggregate rather than the case as to why you would not.
Agreed.
Okay, fair enough. I would agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Other thoughts on any of the first four questions at this point?
Are these questions meant to raise the issue of whether there should be, say, a class of hazards or types of chemicals for which maybe there shouldn't be a de minimis? Like,
we're going to get to that, Joe. That's okay. Did you ever get your the questions?
I did, yeah, I have them. I just not.
Oh, so I'm looking at what I'm trying to decide is whether we're ready to go on to five and six.
I see. There you go, five. Yeah, that would be okay. Right.
This is Todd. I think the only thing is when we've been talking, it says if the level is set chemical by chemical, which I think we've kind of agreed to. What would be the basis? And I think, again, that's going to be one of the questions that it depends, because not all of the chemicals are going to fit in the same box with each of these, you know, hazard threat or exposure threat based on the use of the material and the formulation of it. So I think it would be something that's chemical by chemical, but which way do you actually do it is going to be determined really on a case-by-case basis almost.
All of us sort of struggle with what the scope of the regulations will be at any given time, and I think at least, well, I won't make an assumption about anyone else. I'm assuming that the way you're going to get into this is at least at the beginning on a relatively gradual basis and figure out what works and what doesn't work, rather than to jump in with a huge effort in terms of both chemicals and products. I mean, if we go back through our discussions, that seems to be the way we've always heard it. And you're going to learn a bit more about some of the practical
We lost you, Bill.
Well, I'm my nose is 6 inches from the phone, which is really the closest safe distance I can come.
I don't think it's your fault. It's something in the system. It's just
because there's
something to be aware.
There's some kind of pounding going on in the background somewhere. I think that's meeting out.
Yeah, you're actually, your voice goes into a de minimis.
All right. But what I was saying is that we, I think, all are kind of assuming that the way this will ultimately get implemented is on a bit of a gradual basis, rather than jumping in with hundreds of chemicals and hundreds of products, and that you're going to learn about some of the hard cases along the way, and we'll undoubtedly be having some of these discussions. At least that's what I think I hear from the members of the group.
Very safe assumption.
Okay, so here we are, and it is, by my watch, it is what, 10:54 Pacific time and 12:54 here in Central. We have a break scheduled for straight up at the hour. What I'd like to do is perhaps propose that we take 10 minutes at this point, and then attack questions 5 and 6 and see where we get to on that, and then do triage from there. Is that acceptable to the group?
Sounds good.
Sounds good.
And I would just, I'd also add, Odette, are you, you have significant information now on questions 1 through 4?
Well, I'm still feeling a little lacking in terms of the question of what would be the basis for a chemical-by-chemical determination. I know Todd said it will depend, and I understand that, but what we would need some guidance, or we would like some suggestions from all of you on, and maybe this be a homework assignment, is, okay, what are those different conditions that it would depend upon, and for each of those conditions, what would you recommend be the basis? So something for you to think about more.
And that's something I'd like you all to think about perhaps during the break, and certainly before the end of the call. We'll discuss how to get, you know, a bit more directed kind of recommendations to DTSC from each of us. Let's go ahead and take 10, and I will see you at 5 after the hour.